3, 2, 1.
Good morning. I'm Dwayne Olson, your host today for Education Matters on WGTD-HD, Gateway Technical College, Kenosha, Wisconsin, at 91.1 on your FM dial, and 101.7 in Elkhorn, and 103.3 in Lake Geneva. WGTD is a member of the Wisconsin Public Radio Network. Today's guest is Professor Todd Allen Price, Director of Policy Studies, Educational Foundations, and Inquiry at the Wheeling, Illinois campus of National Lewis University. Dr. Price lives here in Kenosha and holds his PhD from UW-Madison. Dr. Price has been a guest on Education Matters several times before, so welcome back, Todd.
Thank you.
It's good to have you here with me today. And Todd is one of those people that I turn to provide the big picture on contemporary American education and especially public education. So now that 2017 is well underway, we can see that this is a year of changes and perhaps a few more changes are in store. In fact, maybe many more changes are in store. As a result, it is even more important that we understand where we are and the possibilities for the future. So first of all, let's get a little more background on today's guest, Professor Price. Briefly tell our listeners about your recent activities at National Lewis University, your teaching, your administrative duties, et cetera, et cetera. And I know you're traveling tomorrow.
Yes, indeed. So first, I have a couple hats that I wear. The primary one at this point is Director of Policy Studies. And what that amounts to is I participate in lobbying and advocacy efforts on behalf of teacher education. It's been an interesting ride. I have what feels like a marginal role at the national level on a committee called the Government Relations and Advocacy Committee, and that's with the American Association of Colleges for Teacher Education.
AACTE.
Correct. And so in that capacity, I'll be in Tampa next week with several other regional representatives, and we're going to be looking at essentially rules, regulations, and education reform writ large. The other piece that has emerged that I actually really enjoy, because the other one is difficult, is working at the Illinois level with the Illinois affiliate of AACTE. And they're real delightful people to work with, and we're trying to do some advocacy level at the statewide, which is a heck of a lot closer than to Kenosha.
I can imagine. And so, and I assume you teach too.
I do. I have a couple of my favorite classes are in the policy area. I have a critical policy class that is a regular class every summer with our doctoral students.
Uh-huh.
And then I have an online class, which is, it's my favorite. I'm not so sure it's the favorite of my students.
Okay.
But it's educational leadership, and it's basically looking at public policy, and that's an online class. So we're still experimenting with making that what it's supposed to be.
There you go. You know, and hearing you talk about your activities with AACTE then makes me think my older daughter works for the St. Paul Public Schools, and she now is on the NEA Board of Directors. In fact, she's down in Florida right now,
yep.
You know, doing her thing, you know, as a member of that particular group. Okay, so before we get started on some other issues, I want to discuss the funding of Wisconsin's public schools in this last decade, since I've not been clear on exactly what has happened or what is happening. So Act 10 of the Walker administration provided the initial start by requiring most Wisconsin public employees, including public school employees, to pay approximately 5.8% of their salary towards their retirement and increased contributions to their health insurance. Historically, public employees had negotiated most funding to come from their employer in lieu of salary. How has that been carried out, this Act 10 that we hear so much about? And now I think we're hearing the idea of spreading it nationally.
Mm-hmm. So I had the same question. And so
I
did what educators usually do, and I looked for some research, and I found some.
Great.
Essentially, there's seems like kind of the most important study is called Teacher Compensation Standard Practices and Changes in Wisconsin. And there's some interesting points in here that I hope to depart from. One key element in this report, and it's basically out of Wisconsin Center for Educational Research, and we might maybe make a link for folks if they want to dig up and see who the authors are and what their ideas are. But essentially what they're doing is they're saying, so The main change with Act 10 is that it's revising teacher compensation systems in Wisconsin. For most teachers in the past, they would have what was essentially a scale, and they still have that in places like where I work in Chicago, where it's very much a very well-organized lane change that you make as you get more expertise. Salary schedule.
Right.
And so what we have now, and this is really the main change of it, is any number of models out there. And the researchers themselves, I think it's interesting, they say, is that there is no one prominent model out there. They're researching it now. We're 5 years in or so. And they're saying, it's really up to the devices of the various local school districts how they imagine this. Now, where I come into that is specific. When Act 10 went through the first time, my class literally were folks that were aspiring to be teacher administrators. So they, of course, are interested in compensation budget issues because they got to pay attention to that. And what we did was we compared the materials across districts. And we also looked at what was called the handbook. Essentially the employee handbook, because of Act 10, every single school district has to have this faculty handbook that really supersedes what was done before at the bargaining table with the union.
In lieu of a contract.
In lieu of a contract. And so we did, as an exercise, we compared and we found wild variation in that. Some school districts that had 300 pages, some that had 12 pages. And so what we have right now across Wisconsin is essentially a quote-unquote, for lack of a better word, a free market in teacher compensation. Unfortunately, and for free market enthusiasts, that sounds great, but sometimes that can also result in a race to the bottom, where in fact what you're seeing is coupled with Act 10 that, to be fair, some school administrators would say that they liked because it freed up their hands to be able to juggle this. And I heard that from the super.
And negotiate, exactly.
And negotiate. I heard that from the member up in Milwaukee. At the same time, what it is, it's this free market where you essentially have teachers vying for what is going to be the best offering, and that might not be the school district that they live in or the one that they would aspire to help. They might essentially be. And this is what my friend Kim Cockle in Wisconsin School Rurals Alliance, he can't keep up with what the salary is being offered outside of his rural area. So the direct impact for his rural schools, and he represents a whole bunch of rural schools, is that they can't keep pace with what can be paid in a more, shall we say, resourced district. So you lose teachers in that instance. The other piece is that there's a deprofessionalization that's going on. There's no doubt about that, especially when the governor lowered the standards for what you need to be a licensed teacher, with the legislature, of course. So you've got a free market for compensation, which if you're a free market enthusiast sounds kind of good, but in practice it doesn't seem to be working all that well because it's like school districts can't keep pace with what a given school district might offer. And the salaries are kind of flat too.
Yes.
So that's not a good thing in a free market. And decoupling credentials, certification, licensure, and deprofessionalizing. To my estimation, it's not a good formula for sustainability. And that's exactly what the report is wondering or worried about, is how sustainable is it, Duane, if you're a new teacher going in, you don't really have a good sense of where your salary is going to be 3 years from now.
Yes.
Is that a good thing to build a career on?
And also that certain disciplines then, like science and math and maybe special education, where there's shortages and that sort of thing, and technical education, those people can negotiate and are the ones
Correct.
Who are doing a lot of the negotiating. And I suspect then, in order to pay those people more, then you got to hold the salaries down for probably elementary teachers. Is that it? Is that what happens?
Well, that seems to be a reasonable conclusion if you have a limited pot of money. Now, one of the things that is the wild card in that equation is that local school districts have had to go to referendum. And so if they're feeling that locally that they're not getting enough funding from the state, which they're arguably or not, then they can go to a referendum. There's some limitations on that, but in fact, there's been a significant increase in referendums being passed to bring in some more funding for the school districts, which I think is a very hopeful sign, which shows that the residents of a given community actually value their school so much that they're willing in these difficult times to literally go to a referendum. But the other piece, though, that's interesting about the compensation issue is that there's this supposition that, you know, teachers are kind of locked into this salary schedule and, oh, don't we want to pay more for great teachers or give them bonuses or incentives? And that's had a conversation across party lines. In fact, I'm trying to reference, for example, a very explicit one that happened in the recent Obama administration.
Okay.
And they came up with a document. It's the most prolific and important white paper in their, initiative as far as teacher education called the Respect Document. And Respect Document essentially said, we want to keep great teachers. We want to incentivize great teachers. And this is how we do it. We give them a career path towards teacher leader. And so that teacher leader, and Obama administration did not invent that. That was something that was discussed by the unions, the professional education associations for several years. It's just that they actually codified it in this document. And they said, well, for the given teacher that is really able to move more than her classroom but can help a school district in an initiative like an RTI or English Language Learners or some big initiative like that, they should get a compensation that's commensurate with that level of professionalism and that they could be arguably relieved of having to teach every single day in the classroom, but they would still teach in the classroom, but they would also be doing professional development for the whole school district.
Right.
So that was actually something that did have some traction in some states, including there are teacher leaders up in Wisconsin and Illinois. But it's really a creation of the profession to say, we do want to keep great teachers in there. We do want to give some incentives and some bonuses. I think there's just a lot of skepticism over a whole free market model for teachers because, first of all, teachers that are going and aspiring individuals that want to become teachers are really not going into it for the money. They're going into it for the love and the passion and the supports. And we need to support them so they can become great teachers as opposed to trying to throw all these free market schemes at them.
I have a granddaughter who teaches in a suburb of Madison, and she is on a four-person team that is mentoring then the new teachers in that district, the first year, second year, and third year teachers in that district. And she's one of two secondary teachers, and then there are two elementary people then and they split those and work with those people, and that's their full-time task, which I think is absolutely incredible. And important, in terms of inducting new teachers into one school system.
Well, we need a teacher leader at every single school because that teacher leader can also be involved in performance evaluation. They're closer to the teacher, perhaps, than the administrator. And so that's a really key person. I'd like to see that grow. Okay.
One of the things I want to mention in connection with what you just said, though, I think northern Wisconsin, from what I'm reading, is having the problems in terms of attracting and holding teachers. They're talking about, it used to be that there were 30 applicants for a particular position, and now we get three or something like that, and then they don't stay very long, or we don't maybe even attract them in the first place.
And I can't speak eloquently to exactly every county where they're at, but if you did look at a grid of the state, which I have seen out of the DPI, Department of Public Instruction, they show some of the most impacted areas in terms of poverty are indeed those northern areas. Those are some of the areas that are the rural areas, even as much, if not more so, than urban areas that are really been impacted by the economy, which translates to whether teachers can make it in those areas.
And what is occurring under Act 10.
And what is occurring under Act 10.
Okay, in the current biennium, Governor Walker has proposed increased funding for Wisconsin's public schools, as well as for vouchers of some $200 per pupil this year and $200 per pupil next year. Given that the school district employees were paying 12.6% or 12% of their salaries for retirement and health insurance. I guess for health insurance, this and I guess this gets back to Act 10 too. Also, this strikes me as an effort to reduce teacher salaries, which I believe would reduce the attractiveness of teaching as a career, and particularly given that there is currently a significant reduction in enrollment in teacher ed programs in Wisconsin and across the country. Is this a way to reduce teacher salaries as well as avoid taxing the community at large to support public schools?
You know, I would say it is on the face of it. I had a few reactions in thinking about this question. One is that it seems sort of analogous to robbing Peter to pay Paul. I mean, the money's got to come from somewhere, and there are costs associated with education. And the bottom line is, to what degree do we value well-educated teachers and effective classrooms where we move kids forward? One of the things, to be sure, it is apparently moving in the right direction to have more funding for the students. And our current Department of Public Instruction superintendent, Tony Evers, acknowledges much. He's in a race with Lou Holtz. But he acknowledged that, yeah, this is in the right direction, Governor, and it's not enough, but it certainly is commensurate with what DPI was hoping. So they're cautiously optimistic, I think, if you could appreciate that part. One of the things, though, is it's not beating a dead horse, but it is important to take into mind that there is a well over $1 billion cut from public K through 12 education in Wisconsin over the last 5 or 6 years.
Back in 2011 when Act 10 came in.
Yeah, so we're still playing catch up for that. I do think it's very important and fair to say, I will give the governor kudos on the student, unrelated to this one, but the college tuition, that he's called for another freeze for college tuition. And I must say, it had been for many years disheartening to see across Republican and Democrat governor lines, nobody was stepping up to that piece. Now, I'm not sure I like the way Governor Walker's doing it, but it is important to recognize, from a student going into college perspective, the daunting task of having to take out so much loans or pay for your education. It is heartening, at least, that there is this freeze on the tuition. So I'll give him some credit there. But the thing that I think is I disagree with the governor specifically, and I think a lot of people do that are looking at it from a social justice angle, is that he's proposing this equality over equity type of funding, which he means, and his supporters could consider this, and maybe it's I'm misreading it, but at least the people I'm talking to are saying, what he's arguing is that you give this lump sum to every school district.
Fee.
It's a flat fee. And essentially, as we know, that's not a very progressive way to fund because there's more need.
And it doesn't respond to poverty. Districts like Racine.
Yeah, so that's the philosophical biggest difference, is this notion that you can somehow do this flat funding, and that's going to underserve the people that are already underserved. The other piece that has just kind of been a bit of a bug in my craw is that the special education students are still not, again, for many years, bipartisanly, we've been failing to fund at the level that we had committed to with special education.
Isn't that interesting?
Oh, it's remarkable. I mean, it really, Republicans and Democrats both should be ashamed, kind of shameful of this at our least, resource kids. We just have not gotten to that place, and we've got of equity in terms of funding them for what they need. I was very disappointed in the Kenosha University School District that they didn't opt to and still haven't opted to move forward even more with the gifted and talented programs. They've got this great program, and I must say, personal aside, my child is in it.
Yes.
So he gets great benefit from it. It's a lovely program.
Yes.
And I talked with, not to name drop, but I talked with some superintendents previously, and said, this is such a great program. Why doesn't it get expanded? And one of the former superintendents said, get me. This should have been done 10 years ago. We could have expanded it in a middle school or further. The whole point, by the way, is that gifted and talented means that these particular kids are high achievers because they learn in a different way. And I've seen, not just with my son, but with many other kids, that indeed they actually need a different type of curriculum, much as kids would on the special education.
Yes,
and this
exactly.
is not taking away from kids at special education. We need to fund kids that need the help here. And we need to help fund the kids at the other side. Demonstrably, these are kids that need a challenging, very rigorous curriculum. It's not more, Dwayne. It's different. And I think the school board gets it. But I must say I was literally disappointed that the school board is not being more aggressive about that. I learned from several hearings in Illinois that, in fact, only about 18% of the kids that otherwise qualify in this gifted and talented area get the services they need.
Is that right?
18%, that means 82 kids out of 100 are kind of bored in the classroom because they're so far ahead and they're not getting the challenging curriculum. Irrespective, great teachers can do wonderful things, and I've seen it with my kids and with a bunch of kids, and they can differentiate and move this forward. But the point is that we're actually not doing more than enough, and we should be doing more than enough, and we should be pushing the state if the state's keeping us from having the funding to do all that. So I'd like to see more boldness in terms of our boards to get more languages, more services for all of our kids.
And I'm wondering if we aren't seeing more diversity in terms of schools, because I'm looking at Racine Unified, and they've started a Montessori program in the Racine Unified School District, and they've moved to academies at the high school level, and they're working on changing their middle school curriculum, starting next year. And that sort of thing, because it seems to me that there's movement in that direction. Maybe it's not enough movement. Maybe there aren't enough resources either in terms of that movement.
Now that you mention that, what's interesting about the term diversity, right, is that there has been much discussion about diversity, and it usually revolves around race or religion or different orientations. The thing is there's also, and this is one of my colleagues who really brought this to my attention, there's diversity in terms of how kids learn, frankly.
Yes.
And that crosses class lines, that crosses all kinds of different lines. We're only on the cusp, really, of understanding how unique kids really are in terms of how and what they're able to learn. And so our school system needs to radically rethink diversity. We have to really think about how we provide the diverse options. And that's not just talking about school choice, because I know that's what our new superintendent nationally wants. We're talking about options, real options, in terms of how kids get the curriculum that they need.
I want to skip, I guess, to question 11 that I have, on the list that I submitted to you. One of the interesting educational figures we have seen recently in Racine County is the 15,000 adults who don't have a GED or high school diploma. And that was in the Journal Times on December 30th of 2016. These people are above the age of 25, and 9,000 live in the city of Racine, a community of 78,000. I find that absolutely shocking. What does that say about American education? How should this information be addressed? I almost think that it's because of this lack of diversity that you're advocating has produced this. And we really have to make a big change in our educational system to respond more to this diversity.
We absolutely do. And we know from history that we, first of all, want to be careful about tracking students.
Yes.
At the same time, because tracking can be embedded in those social engineering and racism, in terms of having kids would otherwise get a college education being pushed on a vocational track. But that is not to say that we shouldn't have a much more robust vocational track. Vocationalism
absolutely.
Today is not the same that it was 100 years ago. So vocationalism today calls for from fairly exaggerated and very powerful learning curves and skills in the science, the technology, the engineering, the mathematics. So we could very well be taking these folks that are otherwise underemployed and putting them to work through school-to-work type of programs. We have had a school-to-work program in Wisconsin, and I think it's been reasonably successful. But I think what we're seeing is a social problem, which is that we have adults that are woefully undereducated. And I guess the governor would agree with this one. I mean, he always talks about this and says, we got the jobs. We just don't have the personnel to fill those jobs.
Yes.
So we need to make sure that those statistics you point out, which are pretty shocking for sure, are addressed by having lifelong learning and adult education programs that are for folks at 25 years, they are looking for a job. I mean, they are not able to survive without a job. So we have to make it very vocational at that end. But that doesn't mean that it has to be, outfitted to the jobs of the 20th century. We have other means, and other needs.
A friend of mine was telling me about a meeting of school administrators west of the I in Racine County, and they had a couple of the leading legislators from the area there, and the legislators were complaining to these school people about the lack of people with the skills, the technical skills and that sort of thing. And one of the superintendents apparently responded to the effect that, well, what do we test? We test reading and math. And you don't test technical skills. Mm-hmm. Now, and so we produce what you evaluate us on. Mm-hmm. And so I thought that was really an interesting response, and yeah. I'm sure gave those legislators something more to think about.
Absolutely. There's a study about the PISA, you know, the international test that's
yes.
looking at a proficiency. So anyways, the argument is just this, is that, in fact, we don't really test for those or entrepreneurial skills. We're testing very narrowly to this subject matter or kind of school knowledge.
Yes.
Whereas what we really need to do is find out how these folks can perform and what they need to perform in a quote-unquote 21st century workplace. and that entrepreneurialism is key.
Yeah, and one of my thoughts in terms of school knowledge is it's cheaper to do school knowledge by
sure.
having 25 books and 25
right.
desks and a single teacher rather than having equipment that changes every 3 years or every 5 years, and you mm-hmm. have to update mm-hmm. that equipment and so on. So mm-hmm. maybe our society is on the edge of something in terms of changing education, but it's going to be costly.
It is going to be costly, and to your point, the standardized testing system that a lot of schools are built around, the basic issue about that that's understated is it's actually very cheap because it's en masse. You just fill in a lot of bubbles, you get those bubbles punched. But actually to do assessment, the formative, the diagnostic, that assessment that goes right back into the student's degree plan,
yes,
that's personnel. That's expensive. And yet that's what we need to do. And so that's to your point. We have to think about what the investment is.
But my impression, too, is that I think business and industry is also willing to step in and provide facilities and assistance and so forth. Now, maybe mm-hmm. not as much mm-hmm. as I think, mm-hmm. but I think more than we've given them credit for.
Business has to be a partner in this. They've
yes.
historically have been a partner. We just have to make sure that we bring business in, but we have to be careful about bringing in a business model, because education is more than that.
Oh, exactly. Yeah, right. Okay, at this point, I want to remind our listeners that this is your host, Dwayne Olson, and you're listening to Education Matters on WGTD HD at 91.1 on your radio dial from Gateway Technical College, Kenosha, Wisconsin. Today, I am visiting with Dr. Todd Allen Price of National Lewis University. We've discussed a variety of current education issues related to American public education. And now back to our discussion. I want to talk, too, about vouchers here in Wisconsin, because that is something that seems to be more attractive across the country, too. We have state-funded vouchers here in Milwaukee, Racine Unified, and across the state. Governor Walker's proposal for the next biennium indicates that he is also seeking increased funding for these vouchers, I think equal to what he's proposing for the public schools. What's going to happen 10 years from now, 20 years from now, in terms of schools in Wisconsin? Wisconsin's teachers' unions regard this as taking funds from public schools. How do you analyze this?
Well, there's a couple things. First of all, it's in the language of voucher, what that means to the American citizen. When they hear a voucher, they think of something you can take to Marriott's Great America, or you can take to a store in lieu of something else. What it really is public taxpayer dollars subsidizing private schools. That's what vouchers are. And of course, Wisconsin is the birthplace of a lot of this. In Milwaukee, the
yes.
parental choice program 25 years ago, that was the original experiment to see if this quote-unquote voucher experiment could produce bona fide results. Well, I'm actually suspect of the idea that that the country is interested in going down the voucher path. I think it's more a very narrow group of fairly well-heeled foundations and, political operatives that see a value in dismantling the public school system and breaking it up into a marketplace of schools. So that's appealing to them. But I don't really hear too often many parents clamoring for vouchers. They're clamoring for choices. That's different from vouchers. So choices, yes, is an American phenomenon. We always want choices. Everybody wants their kid to go to the best school, have the best teachers, have the best. We all get that. But how do you get to that choice? So what Governor Walker, and in league with some of the organizations that want to privatize public education, including the DeVos family, from which Betsy DeVos, our superintendent now, Secretary of Department of Education, what they're aspiring to is they have this ideological belief that if you have all of these different options, then it's going to raise the bar for everyone. Everybody's going to compete, and we're going to have a great outcome. Well, So getting to what does this look like in the future? I don't think it's frankly sustainable. I think it's a bit of a pipe dream. I think there are going to be a continual growth in various sectors of our country, and there are different states that have embraced it more widely than others. But there's also some correctives on it, which is that if a given private school, for example, takes money from the federal government, until very recently, that means they also have to abide by certain rules of the federal government as
well. But not as many as the public schools.
Not as many as the public schools, that's to be sure. There's been fights this way in terms of what assessment and what data and what materials do you have to produce. But nonetheless, there is that challenge where if the federal government gets involved, or the IRS, God forbid, there's going to be auditing, and there's going to have to be accountability one way or another, that you're going to have to respond to these pieces. And the whole point of a private school is to be absolved of those things. Why would a private school want to have any relationship with the federal government? In fact, many private religious schools have that very purpose. They want to teach about their particular God, their particular religion, their idea. So it's an uncomfortable, irrational fit to assume that we're going to all of a sudden send a bunch of kids to these private schools. I beg to question whether we have enough private schools, in fact, that are going to be able to take up all the kids that would be coming there if the vouchers were lavish enough to give them the education. And what happens when you can't serve those kids? Where do they go? They go right back to the public schools.
Yeah.
So the places that are on display of how, quote-unquote, choice options have not worked is a place like Chicago, where you have a school district that has experimented with charter schools that are not really like the charters up here, but that are really, really run by educational maintenance organizations, for-profits. They struggle. They once in a while you get one that's doing well, and then it doesn't, and then it sometimes folds up. We had the same experiments with vouchers, voucher schools. Some voucher schools have taken the money and run and closed up. Then what?
Well, we've seen that in Milwaukee many times where the DPI then closes down a voucher school because they haven't met even the minimum requirements for those schools.
Yeah.
And think of the kids who have been miseducated in those particular schools as a result. I've never seen any research on that.
Yeah. I mean, we have one system of schools, and it's a public schools, and we have these other variations that are being driven ideologically, politically. Of course, if you did the math and 20 years out and you're trying to sustain two systems, there's no way we can do it on our present funding. So were the governor or Betsy DeVos, and Betsy DeVos in recent hearings, was kind of unequivocal about, she didn't really speak to, what in her role she would do to advocate. She's got to represent the public schools largely. So I don't know where she's going to land in this. But her organizations like All Children Matter and the American Federation of Children and these other organizations, yes, they're going to continue to push for privatization. I just really think that it's not practical. I don't think it works. And I think that what we're going to see is a corrective in the years ahead, which is that, especially in places like rural areas, they've got one or two schools. They can't afford to have their public school disappear. There goes the whole community. So I think you're going to see even rural, folks that haven't paid much attention to the voucher debate get concerned about why there's this other system being created. To your point, it is growing, but I don't know how sustainable.
How much longer it's going to grow. Mm-hmm. And another legislative development in Wisconsin in this last decade is allowing parents who send their children to private or parochial schools to deduct the costs of tuition, books, fees, etc., up to a certain amount. And I think it's $10,000 for a high school student from their Wisconsin state income tax. So how is this affecting funding of Wisconsin's public schools? I mean, there's another source of money that's being taken from that would have been available.
Yes, yeah. It has to come from somewhere, and again, it's questionable why public taxpayer money should be going to private schools. It's really a fundamental.
So you see this being corrected, say, as we move down the pike. It's going to be a struggle in terms of being corrected, but it's going to be.
I'm optimistic, maybe overly optimistic, that good sense creeps in when people have to think about how they're actually paying for things. And so in many instances, the voucher debate, which is about 25 years now, has been relegated merely to Milwaukee. Now that it's being brought out to the rest of the state and rural folks and religious folks and other citizens in a given area have to reconcile, wait, you're saying public dollars for a religious school? That doesn't sound right. That can't be that way. Yeah. And I think I've heard from religious people that don't accept that premise, that they, even if they love their private school or their religion, don't think it's right for public taxpayer dollars. It's a separation of church and state issue, my goodness. Right?
Yeah, that's what my wife keeps raising, a separation of church and state. But let's talk a little bit about Betsy DeVos, our new Secretary of Education. She has no public school background at a time when 90% of American children are public school students. And she's also particularly supportive of charter schools and voucher schools. So what are your predictions on her priorities and how might she proceed? I think you're more positive that she's going to be more supportive of public schools just because she has to be.
I think that there's certain institutional, challenges, right, that you have a particular job you have to do, and it's just like the executive has to serve the executive branch, the legislative has to serve the legislative branch. I have no illusions about where she came from, and in fact, maybe, you know, your listeners are aware or not, but there were several instances where senators, I'm looking at the folks that have recently filed a letter of grievance against her organization, have criticized her organization as having violated campaign finance laws. I mean, there were, Senator Brown and Sanders, Markey, Merkley, and Udall all sent a letter and said, you owe $5.3 million to Ohio because your organization was violating campaign finance law. So her family has been very much operative in elections all across the country in pushing for privatization. So there's no illusions where they're coming from in that regard. She's also could be considered, I think rightly so, as a religious fundamentalist. There's been, indication in her family about having a very strong, religious sentiment to their philanthropic work and the work they do. So those are the dispositions. What I'm saying, though, is I think that her hands are kind of tied in her role because she's in a cabinet position where essentially what you have to do is mete out the contours of what the law is in the rules and regulations of the Department of Education. What was of more concern to me initially from the incoming Trump administration was floating the idea of dismantling the Department of Education, and that would be a real tragedy because the Department of Education is a large enterprise. It handles not just issues that we're talking about, but they handle issues and initiatives that cut to curriculum, that cut to funding for a number of the populations that we've already mentioned, but just all kinds of different things about how you sustain a country's school systems and higher education. We haven't even talked about higher education, and she's talked very little about higher education.
Right.
So it's actually premature to really think about what she would be doing in that regard. I will say one of the folks that was tapped to look at higher education, who's also a religious person, I believe it's one of the Robertson's family.
From Liberty University?
I'm going to get it wrong. But it's one of the evangelical families that were tapped to talk about higher education. I will say I shared a certain agreement with them on one particular aspect of higher education, which they were talking about the onerous, burdensome, heavy regulatory frameworks that sometimes stifle universities from being able to do. I could concur with that sentiment. So it's going to be an interesting debate and dialogue that's going on about number one, which is going to be in DeVos's wheelhouse, which is to try to figure out how to support public education, how to grow and continue public education. And she'll probably want alternative certification, and she'll probably want some form of, you know, school choice and things of that sort. But the devil's in the details here. But what's also looming is higher education. And higher education is equally, in some ways, even as if maybe more important if we're going to address the needs of our economy and what our adults are doing. Like you just point out, you can't sustain an economy if you have thousands of people underemployed or unemployed. That really becomes a significant sustainability issue, because those are the people that pay for Social Security. They have gainful employment and money that keeps the economy afloat. So I look for DeVos to be kind of following the lead of whatever is going to be left to what the Department of Education's role is with K-12 and with the Higher Learning Commission.
And we haven't even mentioned automation as something taking away from jobs, or, you know, taking jobs and replacing jobs. I just heard somebody talking about trucks and truckers. I mean, that's one of the biggest employment areas in the nation, mm-hmm. and talking about automatic trucks. Yes. As we move into the future. Well, yeah. We are really running out of time here, but so let's talk about the State Superintendent of Public Instruction and the election that's coming up on April 4th. We've gotten it down to two candidates, Dr. Tony Evers, who's current State Superintendent, and Dr. Holtz. So any thoughts on that?
I wrote a few pieces on the Common Core and imagined a couple issues.
Yes.
So, of course, Holtz is saying, and that, you know, he opposes Common Core. Not really sure what that means, because Common Core really is a proxy for other arguments. So you tend to have on one side the folks that say, well, they hate Common Core because it's federal overreach, right? And then there's other folks that say, well, what's the deal? I mean, it's standards. Don't we need standards, national standards, so a kid going to this school, going across the state to this school, would have the same expectations? So it's there's debates about what that really means. But Holtz in particular has tried to make that a wedge issue, because he wants to portray himself as conservative. I don't think it's going to work. I think it's not really significant. The other issues, though, in terms of like early childhood education, that's pretty significant.
And
in terms of what are the plans of the various parties in this regard. The whole part of early childhood education is essentially that we need to think about, how are we serving all of our kids? And given parents frequently working, both working, how do we make sure that those kids have a meaningful education in their earliest years, not just daycare, or that doesn't show a demonstrable benefit to them? So those are some issues. But I think the thing is that unfortunately, I think there's much richer things to talk about in the debates. But I imagine because Holtz is catering to the conservative crowd, he seems to be just saying those types of red meat types of, agendas that will get him some supports, especially with vouchers and choice. But Evers said very recently, he came to Kenosha, and if Holtz comes here, I'll talk more about Holtz. But
yes.
Evers was just here in Kenosha. I don't know if you know.
Oh, really?
But he spoke and said, this election is not about vouchers. That's just, we have so many other important issues to look at, and we have to talk about the funding and sustainability, jobs, things of that sort. That's what I hope, that there's more talk about the relationship of education to jobs.
Okay, so you can influence education by voting on April the 4th and for State Superintendent of Public Instruction. To our radio audience, we say thank you for being with us today as we visited with our guest, Dr. Todd Allen Price, Director of Policy Studies, Educational Foundations, and the Inquiry Program at the Wheeling, Illinois campus of National Lewis University. Thank you, Todd, then, for joining me in this most important discussion of contemporary education issues. I wish you well in your most important work preparing teachers, administrators, and other school staff for our schools, and particularly our urban schools. Finally, tune in next Saturday at 10:30 a.m. for another edition of Education Matters. This is your host, Dwayne Olson, saying thank you for being with us today.